The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware. Welcome to WVUD's Campus Voices, weekly conversations with interesting members of the university community, visitors to campus, and others engaged in thought-provoking research and community service. Stay tuned for Campus Voices on WVUD.
Good afternoon. My name is Matt Hewitt, and on behalf of Campus Voices, I'm interviewing Viet Dinh, and we're going to be talking about his book, After Disasters. Viet, it's very nice of you to allow us to come in and chat with you about this. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
After Disasters takes place after a massive earthquake in the region of Gujarat in India. And as a response, international aid teams come in to aid with the rescue effort. So my novel follows four aid workers from around the globe. There's Ted, who is an American who works for the government in the USAID department, which is an offshoot of the State Department, and his colleague Piotr, who is also American but of Ukrainian descent, and they're there to look at sort of the logistics of the disaster and as well as to, you know, help out where they can. There's also Dave, who is himself from India, and he lives in Delhi, and he also travels to the disaster area, and he's focused specifically on sort of the medical response and at that end. And finally, there's Andy, who's from the UK, a firefighter, and he travels specifically to help with rescue efforts and retrieving people from the rubble. So as these four characters converge on Gujarat, you know, the novel examines both their individual struggles that they're coping with in their life, as well as the disaster writ large. You know, this massive thing, which now they have to contend with. And you know, the storylines weave in and out of each other, and the characters cross paths as the situation continues and as it grows increasingly chaotic as well.
Where did the idea of a story of a natural disaster come from?
The strange thing is, I've been asked this several times over the course of just the publication, and to be honest, the genesis of the story has been lost to the mists of memory, but disasters have always been sort of an interest in mine. You know, not only natural disasters, but, you know, disasters writ large. Just because I think, at least in the idea of fiction, disasters represent, you know, radical change. Mm-hmm. And what I like to examine in my fiction is how do people cope with this radical change in their lives.
Okay. How did you come about choosing India as a backdrop?
For several reasons. One, I wanted to choose a disaster that was international in scope. One that was so massive that it would require an international response, as opposed to, you know, smaller disasters, which tend to be dealt with locally, right, or within the country. So that was one criteria I had for looking for disasters. If that doesn't sound too morbid.
No, not at all. I mean, your selection of an international and large-scale occurrence like this makes sense because you can bring in so many a variety of different characters in a very close setting. So that makes sense.
And the other criteria I had was I wanted to choose a disaster that occurred before September 11, 2001, because I think that was an event that changed the way that we as Americans view disaster, particularly large-scale disaster. So I wanted to, I wanted a disaster that preceded that, so that, you know, Americans still saw disasters as something that happened, you know, over there, or you know, if it was a disaster within the U.S., at most, I don't think any disasters have really gone over a couple hundred deaths in the U.S. that I can recall off the top of my head.
Mm-hmm. And is there a specific event that happened in India that you used as the backdrop, or a town or location?
Yeah, the earthquake that I chose was an actual earthquake that occurred in the northwestern region of India in early 2001. So once I had uncovered that particular earthquake, I sort of knew that this was the one around which the story would center. You know, it's that moment of serendipity when you uncover something that just seems right for what you're doing.
A lot of the reviews that have been given give you great credit for your description of natural disasters. How did you gain insight on these details?
This is one of the dirty little secrets of fiction, but part of it is just a lot of research. So I was going back and doing a lot of archival looks into, for instance, newspapers from India around that time. Also taking a look at some of the narratives that have been published. I'm fortunate to say that I was able to actually travel to India several years after the disaster, of course. But I was also able to interview people who had lived through the disaster. So that's one aspect, is getting sort of the ground rules of the reality right. And then the other half is poetic license and sort of making things up, but making things up that are true enough, that are true to the spirit of what happened, as opposed to, you know, like... as opposed to imagining a superhero came in and saved the day. Mm-hmm. You know, I wanted to stay correct to the vision of reality that I knew was there already.
How would you describe your writing style?
My writing style changes depending on whatever project I'm working on. So for After Disasters, you know, this was based on a real event. So I wanted to get across that idea of sort of verisimilitude, you know, that this is how it was. For different projects of mine, say a short story or something like that, you know, some of these will take on a more dreamlike quality because that's the world I want the reader to inhabit. So it's a way of transforming my prose to match the what I'm trying to create.
Who do you consider to be good writers?
Let's see. Well, for me, I had a few inspirations for After Disasters, and one of the biggest influences, I have to say, for After Disasters was the novel The English Patient by Michael Ondaatje. Mm-hmm. Right? So this is a novel that looks at an incident through multiple points of view. Like I said, this was a great inspiration to me. Let's see. Another book that really helped me during the writing was, interestingly enough, Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad. These are some examples of the people I turn to in the writing of After Disasters. In my own reading recently, I've actually been reading a lot of authors in translation. So for a few years now, I've been on this weird Eastern European kick of reading a lot of authors from that area. So, you know, I would say that, you know, that the Eastern Europeans have a certain knack that I really admire. It's not something that I've tried to emulate in my own writing, but it's something that I do appreciate and lately that I've been seeking out.
Was there a certain point when you were growing up in high school or college, perhaps, that you said, I'm going to write?
This is a, you know, a lot of writers will say that, oh, you know, I've always been writing since I was young and I've always wanted to be a writer. And, you know, I'm just going to hook my trailer to that wagon, because it is something that I've always done. And you know, I recall in elementary school, you know, the assignment was to write, you know, just like a 1 or 2 page little story for Halloween. And, you know, I would go on for like 5 or 6 pages, or until, you know, the weak word processing unit that I used on my computer, you know, with a 5-inch floppy disk would not hold anymore. So, you know, that was the extent to which I had to write. And I knew that this was something I wanted to do as I was growing up, even though I had it in the back of my mind. Well, you also need to do something that will pay the bills, because writing will not do that. So, you know, when I went to college, I chose a quote, you know, practical major. But, you know, even that churned over a couple times during my college career. And then at some point, I just had to say to myself, okay, this is what I really want to do. I've tried all these other classes in college. You know, none have particularly fit me the way that writing does. And, you know, I secretly swore to myself, you know, I would be okay with living in poverty if that's what I needed to do. And for a couple of years, that's what I had to do, was live in a little bit of poverty. But, you know, we all make some sacrifices for the things we love. So
what's the one question that your students ask you the most?
Why did I get this F? practically, I guess the question that they ask the most is, you know, how do I become a writer? And you know, sort of the easy answer, but also the very true answer, is you become a writer by, one, reading a lot, you know, reading widely, reading everything, and two, you become a writer by writing, you know, by sitting down and doing the practical work of hitting keys until the page has filled up, and doing sometimes both of that in conjunction, sometimes doing one then the other, but, you know, keeping both halves of that alive. And I think that's how people become writers.
Some artists will say that they have to, in your example, write every day. It's they have to have that outlet. And some authors that I've read up on also have said it was more of a discipline for them, so they would set up a routine or schedule. Is your habit a little of both, or one or the other, or how would you describe that?
My habit would be absolutely neither of those.
Okay.
You know, I think people's processes are always going to be different, right? And I think that one thing, especially young writers will do, is, you know, they do read up all these books on writing. You know, Stephen King's On Writing is a big favorite. You know, there's Writing Down the Bones by, I believe, Natalie Goldberg. But, you know, that all these different authors will give you different ideas. Like, you know, you need to wake up early in the morning every day and write for 2 hours. Or, you know, you have to carve out this amount of time for yourself all the time. Or whatever advice they give you. But in my experience and just from my own practice, I think it's different for everyone. You know, everyone finds their own particular time that is most productive. So for me, my most productive time is generally from midnight to 6 a.m. You know, I've always been a late night type of writer. A good chunk of this novel was written in that time, you know, whether at, you know, at home or at a 24-hour diner. Those would be the only places that are open at that time, especially in Delaware. I think it's a matter of knowing what time is best for you and trying to preserve that and to enjoy it, even if, you know, your quote-unquote day of writing consists of nothing but you sort of staring at the screen or going down sort of the research click hole.
When you're teaching your students, what lessons do you want them to take away? I mean, you know, what messages do you want to impart on them?
I want to say there are different lessons that I want different students to take away, because all writers, you know, we all have our certain blind spots that we need to improve. But overall, I guess the lesson I would want students to take away is that writing is really all about reading. You know, it's reading other people's work, but in a big sense, it's also being able to read your own work and to step away and to be able to see how your own work fits together, or it might be a little unshapely, or, you know, it might need a nice buzz cut. Whatever your work needs, you need to be able to read it the way you would read a novel from a published author, you know, with that same critical eye and openness to say, okay, wow, that was really great, or, you know, wow, this is a pile of crap.
I'm always interested in how the changing technologies impact the classic disciplines of music or writing, for example. What has your experience been with that?
I think writing maybe hasn't changed that much, because, like I said, writing really requires you to sit down and be at your seat, writing longhand if you want, or typing things out. So there's no easy way to get around that part of it. You know, there are pieces of writing software that I know people have used, right? There's software that tells you, you know, that gives you an idea of, you know, when your story needs to have a change, right? You know, there's software that helps you with script writing, right? Indicating, you know, the first churn, the second churn, the climax, etc. And I know that there's similar software for fiction, but even with all that technological aid, it still has to start with you, you know, pounding the keys furiously until that little ding goes off in your head. I know people don't use manual typewriters anymore, so there's no longer a physical ding, but now, you know, you have to have a mental ding that says, okay, I think this is finished. I think technology has made the research aspect of writing easier, whereas before, you know, people really needed to, you know, delve into the musty tomes of libraries everywhere. But now, so much research is available at your fingertips. And in some ways that can be a danger, because you can sort of get lost in the reeds of research and you know, never come out to be able to do your own writing. But that's part of the drawbacks and also the fun of research, because you you never know what paths your research will lead you down and what you'll discover that might be of interest.
How has the technology changed from the process of you pounding out the keys and you hear the ding, now you have to get it published? So do you still need to find an agent, or is it more online kind of approach? How do you go about that?
This is a big question, because with technology, book publishing itself is going through a little bit of a revolution, right? Because a lot of people are bypassing what they believe to be sort of the gatekeepers of book publishing, agents, publishers, etc., and presenting their work directly to their audience. And in a lot of cases, it's effective. But there's a strong caveat to that, in that for those people who are doing that and being successful at it, for the most part, those works are sort of genre driven, and at least from my experience, it's those certain genres that have that big cult following that will consume the works that people put out. Granted that the work is good, and B, that it speaks to this audience. For the genre that I work in, literary fiction, there's not that big of an audience that that just exists out there. There's no literary fiction con the way there are comic cons or sci-fi cons or fantasy cons, etc., where you get to interact with your possible fans. So for literary fiction, you still need to go sort of through the traditional steps of publishing, the finding an agent and having your agent find a publisher. Because even though a lot of people who read literary fiction, can read it on a Kindle or whatever reading devices, I also get the sense that people who read literary fiction still love the physical object of a book and being able to hold the book. I know I do.
And how would you describe the process of finding an agent? Because that can be very daunting.
That can. Again, this is a matter of research, and finding the agent that you feel is right for you. Because different agents will represent, different things. You want to find an agent who is simpatico with your work. Because first and foremost, your agent also has to be your fan, right? If the agent doesn't love your work and doesn't believe in your work, he or she is not going to be able to sell it, right? So you have to find that agent who you think is receptive to your work, and then is going to love your work. I think when people sometimes look for agents, they'll just send out an email on blast and send it to everyone. And I want to say that's probably not the best approach for that.
After Disasters was published just recently in September, and are you looking forward to your next project, or are you kind of taking a break and seeing what happens, or do you have something in queue next?
I've got a couple projects that are percolating in the back of my mind. I haven't yet moved any of them to the front burner, but I sense that they've been simmering for a while, and they're almost ready to be plated and served. So I do have things that I'm working on, although let's just say working on them passively as opposed to working on them actively.
When you're writing, do the characters begin to evolve and speak to you, or do you have a certain kind of an outline of where you want to go? How does that happen?
For me, I generally have a strong outline of what I know needs to happen. So, you know, there are these certain moments that I know, okay, so this has to happen, this has to happen, this has to happen. And even though I know, you know, in my mind the path that will take me there, always during the writing, you know, as you're walking down this path, you suddenly take diversions. And oftentimes those diversions will, you know, eventually loop back to your original path. And sometimes you take a diversion and you say, oh, there's a completely different path here that will possibly get me to that same destination, or it's close enough to that destination that, you know, I'm just going to follow this this other path for a while. So it's a combination of knowing where you need to go, but also being open to wandering around for a little bit, you know, getting stuck in brambles, being chased by a bear, and eventually coming to where you need to be.
Okay. Julie, do you have any questions that you would like to ask?
I'm really interested in character development. Did you say that the four main characters were all men?
Yeah, the four characters are male.
Is there a specific reason why you chose to do that? Is it?
Well, one of the reasons why the characters happen to be male is that one of the disasters I look at in the novel is not a natural disaster, but it's a disaster that happened particularly within the gay community, which was the HIV AIDS crisis of the 80s and 90s. So with that, you know, that was a crisis that that, you know, the gay male community specifically had to address. And since one of the main characters, Ted, himself is gay, you know, that I think that lent itself towards the other characters being male as well as he interacts with them.
Interesting. Do you have any other thoughts or comments that you would like to add to the interview?
Give the short spiel about, you know, the book is available on sale on Amazon. It's available in audiobook as well as, I believe, on CDs if you're commuting, and on MP3, I just discovered, which was exciting for me.
Excellent.
Talking about technology and all
Yeah, excellent. Okay. Well, on behalf of 91.3 WVUD and Campus Voices, myself, Matt, and Julia would like to thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, excellent.
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and do not necessarily reflect the official views of WVUD or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices, and to find archived episodes, visit our website, www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM, WVUD, and WVUD HD1, Newark, or online at wvud.org.